Up until now, a lot of the economic models we've looked at, things like the classic solo growth model, have felt a bit like a crystal ball. They assume a world that's, predictable, deterministic, and, well, frankly, a little too perfect. You invest this much, you get that much output forever.
Exactly. It's what economists call perfect foresight. The agents in those models, these little imaginary people living inside the equations, they know exactly what tomorrow brings. But if you look at the real world, and specifically the economy we actually live in, it's defined not by what we know, but by what we don't know.
I mean, income fluctuates, a new technology comes out of nowhere and completely changes the game, or a health crisis shuts everything down. Real life is, it's messy.
It is. And that's why today is such a pivotal deep dive. We're moving from those deterministic models to stochastic ones. We're unpacking chapter 7, uncertainty. This is where economists take their mathematical toolkit and really try to model the unknown.
So the mission today is to figure out, how do we make optimal decisions? How much to save, how much to consume, when we have absolutely no idea which version of the future is actually going to happen.
Precisely. We're going to look at the mathematical tools for analyzing these stochastic economies, how we model decision-making under risk, and then finally the massive difference between what economists call complete and incomplete markets.
So let's start with the toolbox then. We keep using this word stochastic. It sounds impressive, but for someone new to this, what are we actually saying here?
Well, at its core, a stochastic process is just a collection of random variables indexed by time. Imagine a timeline. At every single point, something random can happen.
Okay, but in an economic model, everything interacts. So what's the trigger? What's the first domino to fall?
In our models, we usually assume the fundamental features of the economy, like, say, productivity, are the random parts. We call those exogenous variables.
Exogenous, so coming from the outside.
Coming from the outside, exactly.
So productivity is like the weather. It just happens to us. We don't control if it rains or shines.
That's a perfect analogy. And because productivity is bouncing around randomly, it causes the things we actually care about, like GDP, consumption, wages, to also bounce around. Those are the endogenous variables.
And they're determined inside the model.
As a reaction to the shock. Yep.
Okay, so I can't control the weather, the exogenous part, but I can control whether I go to the beach, the endogenous part. But here's the problem. If it's random, how do we plan for it? I can't predict the future.
No, you can't. But you can form expectations. And the text makes a really, really important distinction here between unconditional and conditional expectations.
Let's break that down because I think we mix these up in daily life all the time.
Unconditional expectation is basically the long-run average. If you average across every possible reality that could ever happen, rain, sun, snow, whatever, that's the unconditional expectation.
But that's not very useful for my decision today.
Not usually, no, because you don't live in every possible reality. You live in today where the sun is currently shining.
So I care about the conditional expectation.
Right. Denoted as Eddlers, that is, what do we expect to happen given what we already know right now at Dettler?
Which makes total sense. My expectation of rain tomorrow is very different if I see storm clouds gathering versus a clear blue sky.
Exactly. And this leads to this beautiful little property called the law of iterated expectations.
This was the part of the text where I had to pause and reread. It sounds like a bit of a tongue twister.
It sounds complex, but it's, I think, deeply philosophical. It basically says your best guess today of what your best guess will be tomorrow is just your best guess today.
Wait, run that by me one more time. That sounds circular.
Think about it like this. If you knew right now that tomorrow you were going to raise your forecast for the stock market,
I would just buy the stock today. I wouldn't wait.
exactly. You would update your forecast immediately. You can't predict your own change of mind. If you could, you'd have already changed it.
So forecasts only change when new, unexpected information arrives.
It's surprisingly profound for a math equation. It basically means we're trapped in the present of our own knowledge.
Okay, so another term that kept popping up was stationarity. Why are economists so obsessed with this idea?
Stationarity is all about whether a shock fades away or sticks around forever. Imagine throwing a rock into a pond versus, I don't know, throwing a rock onto a sheet of ice.
Okay, I like this. I'm throwing a rock into a pond.
In the pond, you get ripples. That's the shock moving through the system. But eventually, the water goes back to being flat. That's a stationary process. The effects die out.
And the economy returns to its average.
Right. But on the ice, the rock just keeps sliding, or it stops in a completely new place. If a process isn't stationary, shocks accumulate. The variable drifts and the range of possible outcomes gets wider and wider over time.
So stationarity gives us a sense of stability. We know we'll eventually get back to whatever normal is.
It does. And it allows for something called ergodicity. This is a really practical tool. It just means that the average of a single long timeline, like, say, the history of the U.S. economy, is the same as the average across many different possible timelines. It lets us use history to understand probability.
I want to zoom in on one specific type of process mentioned in the text because I think it's really intuitive. The Markov chain.
Yes, the Markov process. It has this property called memorylessness.
Which sounds like me after a long weekend, but I assume it means something else in math.
It does. It means that the current value summarizes everything you need to know about the past. To predict tomorrow, you only need to know where we are today. The history of how we got here doesn't matter.
The source material used an employment model for this, which was really helpful. You have workers bouncing between employed and unemployed.
Right, a classic example. You have a transition matrix. Every period, an employed person has some probability, let's call it C of dollars, of losing their job.
Separation.
And an unemployed person has a probability, phi dollars, of finding a job.
So it's a constant churn. People are getting fired, people are getting hired. It sounds pretty chaotic on an individual level.
It is, and individual lives are chaotic. You might lose your job tomorrow. I might get hired. It's random, but, and this is the aha moment, the economy as a whole settles into a stable number.
The stationary distribution.
Yes. The unemployment rate settles at a specific point, defined by this simple formula. $0 divided by zero plus FAR. It shows how individual randomness can create aggregate stability.
That's a huge insight. Even if your personal life feels random, the crowd creates a steady state.
Yeah.
Now, for something like productivity, we use an AR1 process. What is that?
It stands for autoregressive process of order one. It's the continuous version of what we just discussed. The formula basically says today's productivity is just a percentage of yesterday's productivity plus a new random shock.
The formula was 6t ln xt1 plus epsilon naught. Let's decode those Greek letters.
The Greek letter rho, or ho, is the key. It measures persistence. I like to think of it as the hangover variable.
The hangover variable. I like that.
If rho is close to one, today is very similar to yesterday. A shock like a sudden tech boom hangs around for a long time. If rho is zero, the shock is gone tomorrow. No hangover.
So a high rho means the economy has a strong memory.
Exactly. And bi dollars is just how volatile the world is, and epsilon is the shock itself. By tweaking these dials, we can model almost any economic timeline. We use something called an impulse response function to see how a single shock ripples through time.
Okay, so that's the toolkit. We have the math to describe the chaos.
Oh.
But economics isn't just about describing the weather. It's about people deciding whether or not to bring an umbrella. How does a human make a choice when the future is a giant question mark?
This is where we have to fundamentally change our understanding of utility. We used to say people maximize utility. Now we say they maximize expected utility.
Walk us through that difference.
Imagine a tree of history. We're at the trunk. The branches split off into infinite possible futures. We don't know which branch we'll end up on. So we look at every possible future branch. We calculate how happy we'd be on that branch, multiply it by the probability of actually landing there, and then we sum it all up.
That sounds exhausting. Yeah. I definitely don't do that when I'm deciding what to have for lunch.
Well, you don't do it consciously, but your brain does it intuitively. You weigh the odds, but there's a catch. We aren't just calculating simple averages. We are risk averse.
Ah, the idea that I'd rather have a guaranteed $50,000 salary than a 50-50 coin flip between getting zero and getting $100,000.
Exactly. Even though the mathematical average is the same, you prefer the sure thing. This comes from the concavity of the utility function.
Concavity sounds technical, but it's really just.
It just means the first dollar you earn is life-saving. It buys food. The millionth dollar is nice, sure, but it doesn't change your survival. Losing that first dollar hurts way more than gaining that millionth dollar feels good.
This brought up a fascinating battle in the text. CRRA versus KRA. Two different ways of modeling this risk aversion. Can you unpack that acronym, SOUP?
Sure. CRRA is constant absolute risk aversion. It basically assumes that a billionaire and a broke student would bet the exact same dollar amount on a risky stock.
Which feels wrong immediately. If I have $1 billion, I'm probably willing to bet more than 10 bucks.
Exactly. The text notes that CRA just contradicts the data. So macroeconomists almost universally prefer CRRA. Constant relative risk aversion.
And that assumes? What?
that you invest a constant percentage of your wealth. So if you have $100, maybe you bet 10%. If you have 100 million, you also bet 10%.
That feels much more realistic. It scales.
It is. And more importantly, it's the only form that is consistent with long-run balanced growth. If risk tolerance didn't scale with wealth, our models would predict really weird behavior as economies get richer over centuries. CRRA keeps everything balanced.
So this risk aversion changes the golden rule of savings, the Euler equation. How does uncertainty change that equation?
This is a critical insight. In the stochastic Euler equation, it's no longer just about today versus tomorrow, it's about the state of the world. We value a payoff much, much more if it arrives in a bad state.
Give me a concrete example.
Okay, imagine an asset that pays you $1,000. If that asset pays you when the economy is booming and you already have a job, it's nice. But if that asset pays you when you've just lost your job and the economy is crashing,
That $1,000 is a lifeline. It's rent, it's food.
exactly. A sandwich when you're starving is worth way more than a banquet when you're full. The math shows we care more about outcomes where our consumption is low.
So let's put all this into the big machine, the stochastic growth model. You take the standard model and we throw in these random productivity shocks. What happens?
Well, when we simulate this, we see two major behaviors emerge. The first is consumption smoothing.
Which is that human desire to keep a steady lifestyle.
Yeah, right.
We hate volatility.
Right. When a positive shock hits, output jumps up. But people don't go out and consume all of it immediately. They save a portion. They want to spread that good luck over time.
And if a bad shock hits, they dip into savings to maintain their standard of living.
Exactly. So consumption ends up being much smoother than GDP. It doesn't bounce around as much. We act as our own shock absorbers.
And what about the capital stock?
Capital is extremely smooth. Think about it. Capital is all the factories and machines built up over decades. One good year of investment doesn't change that massive pile very much. It's like filling a bathtub with a teacup.
The text mentioned a trick called certainty equivalence. It sounded a bit like a cheat code.
It is a bit of a cheat.
Yeah.
Solving these models perfectly is really hard. But if we linearize the equations, sort of make them straight lines instead of curves, a strange thing happens. The variance of the shock just disappears from the decision rule.
So in that approximation, people behave as if the future shock will just be its average, which is zero.
Yes. They just plan for the average. It's a useful simplification, but it misses a key behavior: precautionary savings. The extra money you save just because you're scared of the risk. Certainty equivalence assumes you aren't scared, you're just a calculator.
So it's good for a rough guess, but bad for understanding fear.
Precisely.
Okay, we're heading into the final part, and this is where it gets really philosophical and I think vital for understanding the modern world. Markets. The text distinguishes between complete and incomplete markets. What on earth is a complete market?
A complete market is an economist's fantasy. It's a world where you could buy an insurance contract for literally anything.
Like, I want insurance in case it rains on my birthday, but only if GDP also drops by 2% that day.
Exactly that. These are called arrow securities, a contract that pays off if and only if a specific history of events happens. If you can trade these for every possible future, markets are complete.
And if markets are complete, what happens to risk?
This is the mind-blowing part. If markets are complete, you get perfect risk sharing. Your idiosyncratic risk, your personal bad luck, like losing your job, is fully insured away.
So my consumption wouldn't drop just because I lost my job.
No, because you would have bought a contract that pays you exactly when you lose your job. In a complete market, your individual consumption only fluctuates if the aggregate economy fluctuates. We all rise and fall together.
Sounds nice, but also completely unlike the real world. I got fired on a Tuesday insurance.
Which brings us to incomplete markets. This is the reality check. In the real world, missing markets are everywhere. You can't insure against your specific career skills becoming obsolete.
So what do we do instead if we can't buy perfect insurance?
We self-insure. We
Yeah.
use a single asset, like a savings account, to buffer the shocks. And this completely changes the math. The savings policy rule splits based on your income.
How so?
In that old deterministic world, everyone's on the same path. In this world, your behavior depends on your bank balance. If you have high income, you save more than usual. You're frantically building a buffer because you know you have no insurance.
And if you have low income,
You spend down your savings just to survive. You are consuming your buffer.
you're constantly trying to put yourself back to a safe middle ground.
We call it the ergodic set. In the long run, people fluctuate within a range of wealth. They never become infinitely rich, and hopefully they don't become infinitely poor. They just bounce around, constantly adjusting to the shocks they can't insure against.
It paints a very dynamic picture. You're not just moving along some smooth curve. You're fighting to stay afloat in a stochastic sea.
That's a great way to put it. And it highlights why policy is so important. If markets are incomplete, then government programs like unemployment insurance, Social Security, they are essentially trying to complete the market.
Ah, so the government steps in to provide the aero security that Wall Street won't sell me.
Exactly. They are providing insurance against that idiosyncratic risk that the private market fails to offer. It's an attempt to move us closer to that complete market ideal.
So let's try to synthesize all of this.
Yeah.
We started with the idea that the world is random. We realized we need expectations and probability to model it. We learned that we're risk averse, so we smooth our consumption. And finally, we saw that our ability to handle that risk depends entirely on whether markets are complete or not.
That's the arc. We've translated the chaos of real life into these variables like epsilon for the shock and sigma for risk aversion. It creates a framework where we can actually test how resilient an economy is.
It's fascinating. It takes the fear of the unknown and turns it into a variable you can actually solve for.
That's the hope.
Now, before we let you go, I want to leave the listener with a final thought, something to chew on.
Sure. Think about what we said about complete markets. In that theoretical world, individual consumption only changes when the entire economic pie gets smaller. Everyone shares the pain equally. There's no rich get richer while poor get poorer due to luck.
But in the real world, we see massive volatility in individual lives. Some people crash while others soar.
Right. So the provocation is this. Is the inequality we see in the world primarily a symptom of missing markets? Is the gap between the rich and the poor simply the result of us not having the financial technology to insure each other against the randomness of life?
So if we could truly complete the markets, would inequality as we know it just vanish? That's a massive question to end on. If you're listening, think about that the next time you look at your savings account.
No.
You're not just saving money, you're self-insuring against a stochastic universe because the market won't do it for you. Thanks for listening to The Deep Dive.
See you next time.